that from you.
Very true, said Angus. As always, you are the soothing wind of my raging storm.
Such is my role, she smiled. But just make sure you do make the bastard squirm.
Lennox Craven was not a man given to public displays of emotion, but as he watched Angus Manx march toward him with barely disguised relish, it was all he could do to keep the anger from his face. Dressed in a red toga identical to Manx's, Craven knew he was nowhere near as imposing or impressive a figure as his nemesis, but then he had never set out to make himself a self-styled man of the people. He knew for a fact that Manx's public face was as manufactured as that of any of the dozens of vacuous actors and actresses the UNN Celebrity Channel broadcast day and night. Manx might pretend to be the champion of the common man, speaking out against the perceived injustices of the Confederacy, but hadn't he in fact benefited massively from all the Council of Tarsonis had done? Wasn't Manx a wealthy man thanks to the very apparatus he so gleefully attacked with his speeches in the forum and his incessant interviews on UNN? No. Lennox Craven knew the true face of Angus Manx, which made it all the more galling that he had to stand here as though they were the greatest of friends. It made him want to throw up. Even with bribes and calling in the many favors he was owed, he had not been able to prevent Angus from winning the hearts and minds of the people and the right to speak at the close of session. The council had been most insistent. Angus Manx must be silenced. If one of the Confederates' most treasured and pampered worlds was seen to turn against them, then it would only be a matter of time before others attempted to follow its example. And that could not be allowed to happen. His paymasters were demanding results, and Lennox Craven had singularly failed to deliver them. Thousands upon thousands of people lined the streets, and Craven could not remember a time when such numbers had come out to watch a senator march to the forum. He remembered the year he had been chosen to make the close of session speech, and his bitterness at the apathy the people had displayed threatened to choke him in the face of Angus's popularity. He drew himself up to his full height as Angus and his wife reached the bottom of the wide steps that climbed to the columned portico and the great black doors, beyond which lay the grand debating chamber. Angus turned to give another wave to the cheering crowds, raising both arms above his head and accepting their adulation. He then turned and, taking his wife by the hand, began his ascent of the steps. Craven could see the relish in Manx's eyes, and prayed the man would stumble and fall flat on his face. Anything to puncture the pompous arrogance that surrounded him. But Angus reached the top of the steps without mishap, and Craven fixed a practiced smile across his features and assumed the dignified mien of a seasoned senator who was about to welcome one of his dearest friends.
"Angus Manx, you've brought quite a crowd with you," he said by way of greeting. "And Catherine, you look radiant. A pleasure to see you, as always."
Manx's wife curtsied graciously and said, "Thank you, Lennox."
Angus Manx came forward with his arms open, and Craven's smile faltered. Dear God, was the man expecting an embrace? The crowds roared, and Craven knew he would have to play along with this charade of friendship. He opened his arms as Manx swept him up in a crushing bear hug, then awkwardly patted Manx's back in a suitably brotherly fashion, hoping that this would suffice.
"I know it was you who sent those men to kill me," whispered Mangsk. "I just wanted you to know that before I destroy you in there."
Craven stiffened, but before he could reply, Mangsk released him and made his way to the great doors of the forum. Catherine Mangsk swept past Craven, locking her eyes with his as she went to join her husband. Though she said nothing, her cold gaze pinned him like a butterfly on a collector's wall. Taking a deep breath to compose himself, Lennox Craven turned and followed Angus Mangsk into the forum, already dreading what the damnable man was going to say in his speech. The interior of the Palatine Forum was no less magnificent than the exterior. The floor of the vestibule, fashioned from great slabs of black marble, veined with gold, and its columns fluted and rising to dizzying heights. The alabaster walls were painted with great murals depicting the pioneers of Korhal's heroic past. Revered senators, intrepid spacefarers, great architects, military commanders, and far-seeing philosophers. Angus and Catherine crossed the vestibule and approached the bronze doors of the great chamber of the forum, behind which could be heard the animated buzz of voices. Lennox Craven caught up to them, but Angus did not deign to glance in his direction. Catherine squeezed his hand. Once again, Angus was thankful for her steadying presence. She turned to him and said, "I love you."
"I love you too,"
said Angus without hesitation. Catherine smiled and made her way to a door at the side of the vestibule, which Angus knew led up to the viewing gallery. Tradition demanded that only senators enter the main chamber through this door, so Catherine would need to view proceedings from above with the rest of the families and invited guests. He waited for a few minutes, pointedly ignoring Lennox Craven, until he was sure Catherine would have reached her allocated seat. Then he approached the door. It swung open smoothly, and Angus felt his heart race as he saw the assembled senators and dignitaries awaiting his arrival. "Yes," he thought, "this is my moment."
"There's your mother now,"
said Aelin Pastor, and Arcturus turned to see Catherine Mengsk threading her way through the assorted family members gathered in the viewing gallery. She saw him sitting there, her eyes bright at this unexpected pleasure, and Arcturus felt a genuine moment of regret at what he was about to do to her. Juliana sat behind her father, full of nervous excitement at the thought of seeing Angus Mengsk give the close of session speech in the Korhal Forum. In the time since graduation, she had spent a great deal of time with Arcturus, though, thanks to the constant presence of a chaperone, he had not had a chance to take her to his bed. Instead, they had spent most of their time in closely supervised walks through Stirling, and though he never tired of filling her head with his grandiose dreams of the future, he had begun to tire of her company. Not that that would be a problem soon, he thought, picturing the sheaf of papers nestling in his coat pocket. Only Juliana knew what he planned, but he knew she would say nothing. His mother smiled as she negotiated her way toward their little group, obviously pleased to see him there. She smiled at people she passed, and Arcturus could see the genuine affection in which his mother was held. In addition to being the glamorous wife of a senator, Catherine Mengsk was a patron of numerous charities and spoke out on many issues that affected people from every strata of society. She had been the first to address the subject of child trafficking between worlds, had opened people's eyes to the plight of the homeless in Stirling, and had set up numerous health organizations to aid the many victims of war. His mother offered kind words to everyone she passed, and watching her easy smile and natural grace made Arcturus realize why she was so beloved by the people of Korhal. At last his mother reached them, and Arcturus shifted up on the wooden bench to allow her to sit next to him. She leaned over and kissed his cheek.
"I'm so glad you came, Arcturus," she said, her smile warm and genuine.
"So am I," said Arcturus.
She directed her attention to the Pasteurs and said,
"Aelin, it's wonderful to see you here, and Juliana. Angus will be so pleased you came to see him deliver his speech."
Juliana smiled shyly at Catherine, and Arcturus could see she was a little in awe of his mother.
"Thank you, Mrs. Minsk. Call me Catherine, dear, please."
She smiled, patting Arcturus's knee.
"You're practically family now."
Aelin Pasteur returned Arcturus's mother's smile and said,
"I wouldn't have missed this for the world, Catherine. People are going to remember this day for a long time to come."
"I have no doubt of that," said Catherine,
beaming as the master of ceremonies wrapped his bronze-tipped staff on the tiled floor of the Senate floor. The senators below stood a little taller, and everyone in the gallery leaned forward as the bronze doors opened and Angus Mengsk made his entrance. Angus raised his arms in triumph as he stepped into the vast domed chamber of the Senate, recognizing that this was a symbolic as well as a literal crossing of a threshold. Like the most alluring woman, the Palatine Forum saved its most majestic treasures for last. And, as always, Angus felt a deep sense of pride, awe, and reverence for what this chamber represented. Democracy, free will, and freedom from oppression. The central floor was paved with panels of opus sectile, in which porphyry and serpentine figured prominently. To either side were three broad, low, marble-faced steps, and on the level nearest the floor sat the more notable senators, upon their curule chairs. The two top steps were broader than the others, and upon them stood hundreds of richly dressed men and women, the entire body of the Korhal Senate, and assorted dignitaries granted special leave to attend the close of session. Gray marble wainscoting ran along each wall, finished with a molding above which marble panels were rhythmically placed, with only the interruption of three statue-filled niches to break the pattern. As the wall rose toward the dome, it was faced with tall gray rectangular panels with golden lettering, the constitutional tenets set down by Korhal's earliest settlers, and the principles by which its people were to be governed. The dome itself was made up of heavily gilded lachinaria, consisting of square coffers set with golden disks at their centers. Just below the dome was the viewing gallery, where those important enough to be allowed into the Palatine Forum, yet not sufficient stature to set foot in the main chamber, could be seated. Aelin Pasteur watched from here, as did Catherine, proudly awaiting Angus's arrival. He resisted the urge to wave to her. Looking farther along, he was surprised and pleased to see Arcturus next to her. Catherine had probably emotionally blackmailed their son to get him here, he figured. Briefly, he wondered why Catherine hadn't told him that Arcturus was going to be here, but put the thought from his mind. Where Arcturus was concerned, Angus would take what he could get. He looked up into the dome as thunderous applause swelled from the assembled senators and let the moment stretch as he reveled in the acclaim of his peers. When he judged the moment right, he slowly lowered his eyes to the Confederate flag hung opposite the entrance, below which sat the senior consul's plinth. It was from this plinth that Angus would deliver his speech, and he marched across the floor of the Senate chamber toward it. With applause still ringing in his ears, he stepped up onto the plinth and stared up at the red and blue of the flag. His scathing look made no secret of his loathing for all it represented. Greed, corruption, and moral stagnation. With one swift movement, he reached up and ripped it down. The cheers of the assembled senators doubled in volume. Arcturus watched the faces of the people below in the Senate Hall and gathered around him in the gallery as they clapped and cheered. He was amazed they could be so enamored of his father. Could they not see him for what he was, an ordinary, stubborn man who didn't know how to listen? In that moment, a realization crystallized in Arcturus. It didn't matter what the reality of a person was. It was what he showed the world that mattered. The people of Korhal didn't know the real Angus Mengsk. They knew the reality he gave them. The manufactured persona calculated to win them over to his cause. It didn't matter that his father was as human and as fallible as them. All that mattered was what he meant to them and what he promised them. Arcturus had always known that ordinary people were easy to manipulate, but to see supposedly educated men and women so easily swayed was a revelation. He sat back as his father strode across the Senate floor toward the senior consul's plinth, basking in the applause of his fellow senators. This was a salutary lesson in the power of perception versus reality. But Arcturus had no wish to sit through another of his father's impassioned rants about the iniquities of the Confederacy. He'd heard enough of those over the course of his young life to last him a lifetime. It was time. Arcturus took a deep breath and reached inside his coat pocket, removed the sheaf of crisp papers he'd signed earlier this morning, and laid them on his lap. He looked over at his mother, again feeling slightly guilty about what he was about to do, but knowing that this was the right thing for him to do simply because it was what he wanted to do. Sensing his scrutiny, his mother glanced over at him, and her clapping faltered as she saw the papers laid out before him and the insignia emblazoned at the top.
"Arcturus," she said hesitantly. "What's that?"
"Enlistment papers, Mother," he said, "for the Confederate Marine Corps. I went to the recruitment offices this morning."
Catherine looked down at the papers, her confusion turning to cold dread in the space of a heartbeat.
"Oh, Arcturus, no. Please, no. What have you done?"
She went to lift the papers from him, but he was quicker, and snatched them up before she could take them, as the cheers of the crowd suddenly swelled in volume.
"Arcturus, what did you do?" cried his mother. "Tell me."
"I joined up," he said.
"No, no, you didn't," said Catherine. "You didn't. Arcturus, if this is a joke, it's in very poor taste."
"I'm not joking, Mother," said Arcturus. "As of this morning, I'm part of the officer corps of the 33rd Ground Assault Division, under Commander Brantigan Foley."
"No, no, you're not. This is some kind of prank, isn't it?" said his mother,
and Arcturus saw real panic in her eyes.
"Isn't it? Tell me it's one of your stupid pranks."
People were turning from watching his father below on the Senate floor to the growing commotion in the gallery as Catherine's voice rose in pitch and volume. The applause was still loud, and cheering echoed around the chamber, drowning out their words to all but the nearest spectators.
"It's not a prank, Mother," said Arcturus, cold fury entering his heart at the idea that something this important to him would be dismissed as a prank. This was his life, and she thought he was joking?
"I'm leaving this afternoon," he said. His mother slapped him across the cheek. Gasps of surprise spread like ripples in a pond at the sound of her palm connecting with his cheek.
"You stupid, stupid boy," stormed Catherine. "You stupid, selfish boy! Is this your way of hurting your father? Of hurting me? Do you have any idea what you've done?"
"I know exactly what I've done," said Arcturus, his resolve now hardened in the face of his mother's insulting slap. "And you've just made it easier for me."
Catherine reached for him, but he batted her hands away and rose to his feet. His mother looked up at him, tears spilling down her cheeks, but Arcturus didn't care anymore. He slid his enlistment papers back into his coat pocket and said,
"Goodbye, Mother. Tell Dorothy I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to say goodbye to her.
Tell her I'll write."
"No,"
wept Catherine, her heartbroken cries swallowed up by the clapping that still filled the Senate chamber.
"Oh, God, please don't do this, Arcturus. Please, please, wait."
Arcturus ignored his mother's terrible, aching grief and strode through the astonished crowd sitting in the viewing gallery. He could feel their eyes upon him, but kept his head held high, determined to leave this place with dignity. A strong hand gripped his arm, and he turned to berate the person for this impudence. Aelin Pasteur stood behind him, his face a mask of anger.
"Your father will never forgive you for this, Arcturus."
"I'm not asking him to," snapped Arcturus, shrugging off the Umojan ambassador's hand.
"Of all the days you could have done this, why today?"
demanded Pasteur. Arcturus returned Pasteur's stare with a steel gaze of his own. The man recoiled from the determination in Arcturus's eyes as though struck.
"Sometimes you have to do something dramatic to make your point," said Arcturus.
Pasteur shook his head sadly, turning to look at his weeping mother.
"Well, boy," he said sadly, "you've certainly done that. I just hope you don't live to regret what you've done today."
"I won't,"
promised Arcturus, turning and walking away. Book 2. Arcturus. Chapter 7. The dropship screamed through the upper atmosphere of Sanyan, trailing fire from its wings like a swooping phoenix. The armored plates of its heat shielding rippled with blazing orange fire and left a streaking contrail of vapor in the craft's wake as it dropped rapidly toward the planet's surface. As flying machines went, it was proof that with a big enough pair of engines, you could get anything to stay in the air. Its front wings were stubby, swept forward and down, behind which enormous jet engines coughed to life as the craft hit the atmosphere. Dropships were designed to carry Confederate military forces into battle in safety and at speed, though they achieved neither objective particularly well. And, as Arcturus gripped the metal stanchion next to his head, he knew that, regardless of any other considerations, comfort had certainly not been uppermost in the designers' minds. Dropships could carry anything from troops to siege tanks in their transport compartments, and thus the cavernous bay housing Arcturus's armored marines, designated Dominion Section, was an oily, dust-filled, metallic cavern. The dropship shuddered as it leveled out, wind roar and engine noise making conversation impossible unless carried out over the helmet comms. As well as the 6 armored soldiers, the dropship carried a huge siege tank, its colossal, groaning mass held fast with clanking chains and filling much of the dropship's internal space. It was breaking regs putting this many soldiers in with a siege tank, but the orders had come from on high to get them there like this, and Arcturus wasn't about to question orders this early in his career. His 5 soldiers sat toward the rear of the red-lit compartment on uncomfortable metal benches that looked as though a blind welder had attached them to the fuselage's interior.
"So what's the situation, LT?"
asked Yancey Gray for the 100th time.
"What are we flying into?"
Arcturus sighed.
The irrepressible kid from Tarsonis never let up until he got an answer, and he had a strange, naive belief that the chain of command would keep him informed at every stage of what was going on. He hadn't been with the military long enough to know that the grunts on the front line were like mushrooms, kept in the dark and fed shit.
"Aw, man, how many times are you going to keep asking that, Yancey?"
said DeSanto, her face belligerent.
"LT's going to tell us what's up when he knows, right, LT?"
Diamond DeSanto, or Dia, as her section mates knew her, was a dark-skinned girl who'd grown up on Tirador 9, the daughter of indentured workers who toiled in one of the many spas and resort cities that made the planet such a refuge for the scions of the old families. Armies of men and women who owed money to one of the many Confederate financial institutions were forced to work there to repay their debts and ensure that guests didn't need to lift so much as a finger. Needless to say, Diamond DeSanto hadn't enjoyed that life much, and she'd signed up at the first recruiting office she could find on her 18th birthday. In the 6 months Arcturus had known her, he had seen the core of a good soldier, but one who had such a chip on her shoulder that it kept her mouth truculent and her manner rebellious. Arcturus liked her immensely. And by some strange inverted magnetism, DeSanto recognized a kindred soul and displayed a loyalty to Arcturus that reminded him of the bond between his father and Acton Feld.
"Hey, I'm just asking," said Yancey. "Nothing wrong with wanting to know what's going on, is there? I was supposed to be on leave until this new assignment came down the pipe." "We were all supposed to be on leave," said DeSanto pointedly, making no secret of her irritation at that particular stroke of genius from the brass.
She wasn't the only one annoyed that their leave had been postponed. Arcturus had planned to return to Korhal to see his mother and little Dot. He hadn't been back to see them since he'd joined up, though he had written to them plenty of times over the Confed network. His mother had eventually answered, though her words didn't have the same openness and warmth as did the letters she had sent him at the academy. Her correspondence was filled with news of his sister and of Korhal, and its troubles, but made little mention of his father beyond his continued good health. Dorothy hadn't replied to him at all, and he knew she was probably still smarting with annoyance at his sudden departure. Hopefully, once this mission was over, he'd have a chance to patch things up with his family, as the last year and a half had made him realize how much he missed them. Even his father, which surprised Arcturus immensely. Of course, there had been a great deal of correspondence between Arcturus and Juliana, and it seemed she remained interested in him, though light years separated them. They had arranged to meet on Tirador 9 before he headed onward to Korhal, when his next period of leave eventually came through, and he was forced to admit he was looking forward to seeing her again. Arcturus's reverie ended when Yancey nodded his helmeted head toward him and said,
"I'll bet you anything LT already knows where we're headed." "Yeah, 100 credits says he already knows."
"Hell, I'd take that bet if I thought you had the damn cash," said Chuck Horner, his broad, fringe-world grin robbing the comment of malice.
Horner was what Arcturus's father would have disparagingly called a good old boy, a thick-shouldered, broad-featured hayseed from one of the outlying worlds in the Confederacy where they counted themselves lucky if they had electricity throughout the day. On the surface, that's exactly what Charles Chuck Horner was, and Arcturus had been surprised to find a sharp mind and quick wit behind his "aw shucks" exterior.
"But you ain't got 2 cents to rub together," continued Chuck. "Leastways not after me and Chun Leung won everything but your panties the other night at poker."
"You got lucky."
"Lucky?" drawled Chuck. "My daddy and his daddy before him was playing army poker before you was a glint in your mama's eye.
Taught me everything I know, son.
Oh, yeah? Countered Yancey. Want to try your luck again tonight?
What you got a bet with?
Put in the aforementioned Chun Liang.
I already got your money and your chocolate rations for the next week. You don't got anything else the big dog wants to take off you.
I'll clean Mayumi for a month, offered Yancey. Boy wants to gamble,
DeSantos said with a laugh.
No way, said Chun Liang, hefting his impaler rifle across his lap to stroke the gleaming oiled barrel.
Mayumi was the name Chun Liang had given to his rifle, his pride and joy. He kept the rifle obsessively oiled and cleaned, and where everyone else's gun was battered and scratched, Liang's weapon looked as though it had come straight from the factory.
I'm the only one who handles my weapon, said Liang.
Yeah, that's what the girls on Pridewater said too, quipped DeSanto.
Liang flipped her off.
You want a piece of me?
He said.
I'll show you why they call me the big dog, little girl.
Arcturus listened to the banter, sensing the undercurrent of fear behind their easy back and forth. Thus far, the commanders of the 33rd hadn't seen fit to post them anywhere too dangerous, but even though his soldiers had only mess tent scuttlebutt to go on, they could sense this assignment would be different. Only one member of the section didn't join in on the banter, and Arcturus knew that if there was a god somewhere in the heavens, he had a strange sense of humor. Toby Mercurio, another graduate of Sterling Academy, sat across from Arcturus, his face downcast and his shoulders slumped. Having spent the last 6 months trying to bring Mercurio up to the standard of the rest of the section, Arcturus knew that the life of a soldier was not for his fellow alumnus. Though Mercurio's parents had been wealthy enough to send him to an expensive school, the boy wasn't really Sterling Academy material. He'd scraped by academically, but it had been his above-average performance on the padball courts that had allowed him to graduate. But above average didn't cut it in the professional circuit, and without the safety net of any real qualifications, Toby had floundered in the real world. A series of meaningless paper-shuffling jobs at one of his father's plants had ensued, all of which he'd spectacularly failed at. Followed by a drunken afternoon that had seen him wake with a crushing hangover and a sheaf of signed enlistment papers. In the 18 months since Arcturus had joined up, he'd found that a soldier's life consisted of long stretches of boredom, followed by frantic periods of deployment and shouting, which, in Dominion Section's case, had been followed by yet more periods of boredom. This assignment looked as though it might involve some action, and, as surprising as it was to him, Arcturus realized he was looking forward to the prospect of combat. He'd trained to fight in combat armor, and could fire a gauze rifle with a reasonable degree of accuracy, but it was his understanding of battlefield tactics, combined with his talent for inspiring those around him and making the impossible sound plausible, that had seen him rise to the level of lieutenant. Senior officers had their eye on him to ascend the promotions ladder, but before he could really embark on that climb, he needed some real combat under his belt. Hence, Dominion Section's deployment to Sanyan.
"So come on, LT," said Chuck Horner. "There's a kid, right? You know why we're out here?"
Arcturus felt the eyes of his section turn on him. Their faces blurred slightly through the low-grade plasteel of their helmet visors. "Yes, Charles," said Arcturus, knowing the others got a kick out of his using Chuck's full name. "I do know why we're out here. I'm an officer. It's my job to know."
"So what's the skinny?" asked Yancey, leaning forward. "Pirates? Rogue merc bands terrorizing helpless colonists and their pretty daughters?"
"Something like that,"
agreed Arcturus. Whoops and hollers echoed over the comms at the prospect of actually putting their training into practice. Arcturus held a hand up to quiet his section and said, "We're dropping on a planet called Sarnion, specifically Camp Juno, where we're to rendezvous with other elements of the 33rd and facilitate the evacuation of personnel involved in illegal deep core mining operations."
"We gonna get to kill anyone?"
asked Chun Liang, patting Mayumi's muzzle.
"I hope not," said Arcturus. "But it's likely many of the people on Sarnion aren't going to want to leave their holdings."
"Well, damn! We gotta show them the error of their ways," said Chuck Horner, high-fiving with Chun Liang.
Yancy and Dia looked excited at the prospect, but, as usual, Toby Mercurio didn't join in.
"I bet I kill more than you, Dia," said Yancy.
"Sure you will," sneered DeSanto. "Boy, you barely know which end of that gun to point at the enemy. We get into a firefight, you make sure you stay in front of me, you hear?"
Lines of scrolling text flickered onto the HUD of Arcturus's armor, and the red light of the compartment began flashing.
"Quiet down," he said, his voice easily cutting through the good-natured sparring. "We're coming into land, so look sharp."
Before Sarnion, Arcturus had seen precisely three other planets. Growing up on Korhal, a lush, temperate world of balmy summers and mild winters, he had assumed that most other habitable worlds in the Confederacy would be much the same. His training on the colossal orbital shipyards of Dylar IV and his first tour on Pridewater had quickly disabused him of that notion, emphasizing the point that humans could live pretty much anywhere with enough perseverance. But Sarnion was a world you'd have a serious reason just to visit, let alone live on. As the assault ramp clanged onto the sandy hardpan of the planet, hot, biting winds howled inside the dropship, instantly blinding Arcturus and his soldiers. As they disembarked, a group of engineers barged past them to get to the siege tank, and Arcturus fought the urge to shout at them. Instead, he marched down the ramp and onto the gritty surface of another world. The visor of Arcturus's helmet darkened in response to the sudden brightness as he took his first look at their new posting. Camp Juno nestled in the rocky foothills of a broken series of valleys in the middle of a soaring range of reddish-brown mountains. Dust devils blew down from the high peaks, and the sky was the color of flaking rust. A jaundiced orb of a sun hung low above the tops of the mountains, casting long, thin shadows down the mountains and over the camp. In the middle of the camp sat a modular command center, its pressed metal plates scoured and distressed by the constant assault of wind-borne grit. The rotating dish of a commsat swept the terrain, and a number of depressingly identical buildings surrounded the command center, the standard pieces of kit you'd expect to find around any Confederate military establishment: barracks, mess halls, infirmary, and landing platform, as well as portal-framed hangars, supply depots, and training facilities. Coils of wire looped between six missile turrets spaced at regular intervals around the camp's perimeter, their own dishes sweeping the skies for aerial threats. Squads of Marines jogged through the camp, and industrious SCVs effected repairs to damaged buildings. Despite the number of people he saw, Arcturus sensed a relaxed, unhurried air to the camp. There was no urgency to the training, nor any sense of wariness in the posture of those Marines that stood sentry over the camp. A few heads turned as he led his men from the belly of the dropship, but any interest in their arrival quickly passed.
"So what now, LT?"
asked Yancey, slinging his rifle over his shoulder.
"Where's our reception committee?"
Arcturus was wondering the same thing, but didn't reply. It didn't become an officer to admit that he didn't know what was going on.
They were supposed to have been met by the camp's head of security, but they were completely alone on the landing platform.
"Watch out on the ramp!"
shouted one of the engineers inside the dropship, sparing Arcturus from thinking of an answer for Yancey. No sooner was the warning given than the throaty rumble of the siege tank's engine bellowed. Jetting filthy plumes of blue oil smoke, the tank lurched from the darkness and jerkily drove out onto the sand. Arcturus watched as the tank rumbled away from the dropship with the engineers in tow.
"Damn, that thing's probably older than you, Chuck," said Dia DeSanto.
"Dia, honey," drawled Chuck. "You call it old. I call it experience."
"Well, that is one experienced tank," said Yancey.
"Screw you, son," said Chuck with a knowing wink to DeSanto. "Give me the choice between a filly and a mare, I'll take the mare every time. She knows what she's doing, and she'll make sure you do it right."
"We still talking about tanks?" asked Yancey.
"Tan hut!" shouted Chun Liang, and the Marines of Dominion Section snapped to attention. Arcturus turned to see a fully armored Marine marching toward them from the command center. He saw the insignia of a captain on the Marine's shoulder, and a security detail of two soldiers marched at the officer's back. Arcturus pulled himself to attention, squinting through the glare and dust haze, as he saw a familiarity to the Marine's posture and walk. The captain halted in front of Arcturus and gave him a quick once-over.
"Lieutenant Arcturus Manx reporting for duty, sir," he said, saluting smartly. "Dominion Section is ready for action, sir."
"At ease, Manx," said the captain, and Arcturus smiled as he realized why his superior had seemed so familiar.
The glare visor on the captain's helmet snapped up, and Arcturus found himself staring into the face of Captain Angelina Emelian, the very woman who'd planted the seed of his enlistment so long ago, it seemed, at Sterling Academy. Arcturus relaxed, but only a fraction. Emelian might have been a familiar face, but she was still a captain, and he a lieutenant. Even he had to respect the chain of command.
"Good to see you again, Manx," said Emelian. "So, they made you a lieutenant?"
"Yes, sir," said Arcturus. "All the general's jobs were taken."
Emelian smiled.
"I see you've not lost that smart mouth of yours. Maybe your principal was right about you. They still letting him teach there?"
"No, sir," said Arcturus. "Last I heard, he was doing 60 years at Bar L Penal Colony for embezzlement and fraud. I gather he wasn't a suitable candidate for resocialization."
Emelian caught the pride in his tone and said,
"And I suppose you would have had nothing to do with that?"
"I couldn't possibly say," he replied, leaving Emelian in no doubt as to his complicity in Stegman's fall from grace.
"I thought so,"
said Emelian, jerking a thumb in the direction of his Marines.
"So, what's their story?"
"Dominion Section," said Arcturus. "Ready for action, sir. Just give us the word."
"Dominion Section," repeated Emelian. "Nice name, you choose it."
"I did," said Arcturus with a nod. "I thought it sounded appropriately grand."
Emelian shook her head with a grin and walked along the line of Marines, her stern gaze boring into each soldier and leaving no doubt that they were less than nothing to her.
"Okay, listen up, Marines," she shouted. "Welcome to Sonyan, the most miserable crap hole this side of the core worlds. This ain't boot camp and it sure ain't paradise. So wherever you been stationed before and thought was bad, forget it. This is worse. The chow sucks, the barracks have got more holes than an impaler target, and you won't be leaving without at least one trip to the infirmary. Any questions?"
Most of the Marines of Dominion Section met her stare stoically, understanding that the best response to this kind of rhetorical question was silence. Yancey Gray was, however, apparently oblivious to this piece of soldier's wisdom.
"Why will we be visiting the infirmary, sir?" he asked.
Captain Emelian rounded on him, the visor of her helmet barely an inch from her questioner. Arcturus winced, irritated that one of his marines had embarrassed him.
"Did you say something, soldier?"
she said.
You asked if anyone had questions," replied Yancey. "I do have a question, I mean."
"That's enough, Gray," said Arcturus. "The captain will brief me, and then I'll tell you what you need to know. For your sake, you'd better hope your trip to the infirmary is because you've been killed so you won't go asking any more stupid questions."
Emelian continued to stare hard at Yancey, who kept his gaze fixed on a point somewhere over her right shoulder. Eventually the captain turned away and stood before the section with her hands laced behind her back.
"In answer to Private Gray's question, you will most likely visit the infirmary because you will be getting shot at by disgruntled miners who have illegally begun deep core operations on this rock, which just so happens to be a Confederate-owned piece of real estate."
Arcturus hadn't known that Sanyan was a Confederate world. That nugget of information not having been part of his briefing prior to their departure from Pridewater. Not that his briefing had said much more than, "Go to Sanyan and await orders." In any case, this far out on the rim, who claimed a world was largely a factor of who had the most men and the biggest guns. With the arrival of Dominion Section and the siege tank, it appeared that honor now belonged to the Confederacy.
"Most of these miners have already been relocated," continued Emelian, beginning to pace as she spoke. "But there are a few stubborn holdouts, and it's going to be your job to flush them out. It's going to be bloody work, because these miners are dug in deeper than a Tirador blood strike, but you'll have help. There are 30 Marines and a handful of Firebats here that'll be going in with you. And now we have a siege tank. But make no mistake, Marines, you will be shot at and we will take casualties. That last part I can guarantee," finished Emelian. "Since you lucky bastards are going to hit Taronga Canyon at 0600 tomorrow."
The sun was already bright and hot when Arcturus rose from his bunk at 0500 and made his way to the mess hall to grab some breakfast and gulp down some A-grade military caffeine. Breakfast consisted of high-calorie gunk that tasted foul, but provided the energy a Marine would need for combat operations. As he sat contemplating the brownish sludge spooned onto his tray, Captain Emelian took the seat opposite him.
"Morning, Lieutenant," she said, nodding toward the food. "Not what you're used to, I bet."
"Not exactly," he agreed.
"Though the refectory at Sterling Academy could give this place a run for its money. I can see why the Marine Corps would be appealing to you, then."
They ate their breakfast in silence, and Arcturus took the opportunity to study Angelina Emelian in more detail. She was still pretty, but he noticed a scar that hadn't been there before, which traced a pale line above her ear before disappearing beneath her hair.
"Got it on Chausara," she said without looking up. "There was a prison riot in one of the penal colonies where they keep the worst of the worst, the mass murderers, rapists, and serial killers. We were on rotation there to pick up a batch for resocialization when it happened. I was in solitary evacuating an inmate by the name of Wine Skane when he got one of the guard's weapons and shot me in the face."
"Nasty," said Arcturus, appreciating the ridiculous understatement of his remark as he said it. But Emelian appeared not to notice.
"Yeah, it was, but I was lucky. The bullet ricocheted from the interior of my helmet and grazed me before exploding out the back."
"So, what did you do?"
"There was so much blood around me, the dumbass thought I was dead," said Emelian. "I guess I was out for a few seconds, but once I came to, I saw he was standing at the bars with his back to me. So I got up and broke his neck, and then got the hell out of there."
I'm impressed, said Arcturus, genuinely meaning it.
It's nothing, she said. Anyway, we got our recruits, and I got a new scar I could use to impress Greenhorn lieutenants. So tell me about your section, Mangsk. Are they any good?
Arcturus looked down the length of the table, where the Marines of Dominion section sat chatting with the Marines who were going to be flying up to Taronga Canyon with them.
Yes, he said. Until this mission came up, they were looking forward to going on leave. We all were, but they're good soldiers. Some are better than others, but they'll follow orders, and they'll fight hard.
Good enough, said Emelian.
Arcturus had seen the telltale scars of neural resocialization on the Marines his men were talking to, and said,
Tell me something, Captain.
You have 30 Marines here already, all resocked to follow orders without question.
Yes.
So why do you need us? Emelian answered between mouthfuls of scrambled egg.
You ever fought alongside a resocked Marine?
No.
You wouldn't ask that question if you had, said Emelian. Don't get me wrong, they're perfectly good soldiers and they'll do anything you order them to, but they don't have initiative and don't react too well to changing battlefield situations. Give them an order that's easy to follow and there's no problem, but the minute things start to get a bit screwy, well, they get a bit lost. I keep asking for Marines that aren't brain pan, but they keep sending me more of them.
And you think 6 of us can make a difference?
6 of you in a siege tank, let's not forget.
Of course, said Arcturus. These miners, they must be a tough bunch.
What makes you say that?
You clearly don't think they'll surrender as soon as they see us. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong.
I didn't think so, said Arcturus. Why won't they surrender?
Because they didn't the last time we came for them. They fought back with Goliath walkers, anti-aircraft missiles, and a whole lot of guns. Then again, we didn't have a siege tank last time, or Dominion section, she added with a smile.
The siege tank had left the previous evening and was to rendezvous with them at the mouth of Taronga Canyon, where it would provide artillery support as the Marines moved up toward the miners' base.
Do you remember when we spoke back at Sterling Academy? Asked Arcturus.
Sure, said Emelian. Why do you ask?
You said barely 50% of Marines ever actually see combat. Seems like that might have been a slight exaggeration.
Not at all, replied Emelian. About 50% of recruits to the Marines either wash out of boot camp, are killed in training accidents, get their brains fried by the resoc, or otherwise end up invalided to desk jobs.
So, basically, if you survive boot camp, you're almost guaranteed to see combat.
Pretty much,
agreed Emelian with a wry twitch of her eyebrows. Doesn't sound quite as appealing when you put it like that.
Hence the shift of emphasis, said Emelian,
standing and carrying her breakfast tray to the racks. Arcturus followed her and slid his tray in below Emelian's.
I can see that now.
Emelian turned, and from the steel in her eyes, Arcturus could see that the informality of breakfast was over.
Right. Time to get busy, Lieutenant. Get your men together and be on the launch pad in 10 minutes. We dust off at 05:30, so don't be late or I'll court-martial your ass. Now move it.
Arcturus moved it. Arcturus sat with his gauze rifle against his shoulder and his body braced against the craggy rock protecting him from the stream of bullets that sawed down from above. The sun blazed high above them, a sour, lemon-yellow orb that looked close enough to reach up and touch. His breath came in ragged spurts, and he could taste blood in his mouth from where he'd bitten his tongue in the crash. The members of Dominion section huddled in the rocks with him, each one looking the worse for wear, but still alive. Which Arcturus realized was a bloody miracle, remembering the gut-wrenching terror he'd felt as the explosion had torn a monstrous hole in the side of the dropship, He could recall almost nothing of what followed, save hurricane-force winds roaring through the troop compartment, billowing flames, and the awful sound of battle-hardened Marines screaming in agony. Next thing he remembered, he was lying in a tangle of twisted metal, surrounded by flames and looking up at a pillar of oily black smoke etched on the sky. Hands had grabbed him under his arms and dragged him from the wreckage, and as he'd been propped up against a rock, he saw it had been Chuck Horner who'd rescued him.
"What happened?" he managed.
"Missile," said Horner. "They got a turret set up at the mouth of the valley. Pilot didn't see it, and we got a heat seeker right up a tailpipe. Now at least half the Marines are dead, and the damn siege tank ain't here yet neither."
"Emelian?" asked Arcturus.
"Where's the captain?"
"Captain's out of the fight, sir,"
said Yancey Gray, across the gully from Arcturus.
"I think her back's broken."
Private Gray's words had focused Arcturus's thoughts, and he pulled himself to his feet, using a nearby rock for support. He had to get everyone together and figure out what to do next. Looking over at Emelian's supine form, Arcturus saw that Yancey was dead right. Emelian wasn't going to be joining this fight. Her armor would keep her alive for a while, but her legs and spine were bent into shapes they weren't designed to make, and Arcturus knew she wouldn't last long if they didn't get her to a medical station. 20 meters back down the valley, the gutted hulk of the dropship lay scattered in a mangled pile of fire-blackened steel. The pilot had tried his best to soften their landing, but there was only so much you could do with your engines taken out by an explosion, and the nearest piece of flat ground 100 kilometers away. Thick, billowing clouds of smoke belched from the wrecked craft, and the fire crackled and popped as it devoured ammo packs and stim dispensers. Arcturus had done a quick headcount and found that 11 of the Marines who'd accompanied them on the dropship were dead, and another 8 were too badly injured to fight. 3 of the firebats were also dead, immolated by their own weapons when they'd cooked off in the fire of the crash. That left 11 of Emelian's resocked Marines and 2 firebats to fight alongside Dominion section. No sooner had Arcturus got everyone together than a burst of gunfire ripped down from the rocks above.
"Cover!"
he shouted, though the order was unnecessary. High-pitched pings of metal on rock echoed deafeningly, like an endless box of nails being emptied onto hard stone from a great height. Breathing heavily, Arcturus risked a glance out of cover when the fire slackened fractionally and saw a whole lot of shooters on the rocks above. He guessed about 20 men in body armor, helmets, and tough-wearing outdoor gear. Certainly not soldiers, but more likely mercenaries or a pirate band hired by the miners. Arcturus stuck his rifle around the rock and pulled the trigger, not really aiming, but just wanting to return fire. The armor easily absorbed the recoil, and though his shots went well wide, he felt better for shooting back. Dominion section hugged the rocks, looking up with expressions ranging from the beginnings of panic to relish. More spikes sprayed down at them, and Arcturus watched as a concentrated volley tore up one of the injured Marines. The man appeared to jerk as though being electrocuted. His armor was proof against most small arms fire, but a whole lot of impaler rifles firing in sync had torn through the weakened portions of his plate. Whomever these miners had hired to defend them knew their trade. More shots ricocheted down from above, pinning them in the rocks below their objective, and Arcturus saw they had only 2 options. They could either retreat, skulking back to the valley mouth, or continue with their mission into the teeth of the gunfire. Retreat was not an option that appealed to Arcturus, not when so many men were dead.
but neither did he want to rush to a glorious death in the face of an unknown number of gunmen. From his earlier glance, he'd seen that the bulk of the men ahead were lurking behind jagged outcrops of rock in a narrow defile amid a tangle of wiry brush. Above them, the rocks were a vivid white, as though bleached by the sun. As one group fired, another reloaded. Between them, they kept a near constant stream of impaler spikes rattling and chiming from the rocks around Dominion Section. In the quick glance he'd had, Arcturus saw that the valley narrowed as it neared the gunmen. The ground before their attackers was a sharply inclined, open killing ground that would be close to suicide to charge up. But the rocky walls to either side of where the Marines were pinned could be climbed with only a little effort. About 4 meters above, the ground appeared to become flatter, rocky and strewn with stunted trees and scattered piles of boulders. Ideal cover from which to flank their attackers. Arcturus turned and opened a link to the firebats. The two surviving firebats were hunched in cover, their hulking suits of crimson armor heavily dented and scarred from the crash. But their perdition flamethrowers appeared to be in full working order. "This is Lieutenant Manksk," he said. "Identify yourselves."
"Private Eugene Malik," came the first reply.
"Private Harper Utley,"
came the second firebat.
"Malik, Utley, I'm going to need you two to go straight up the middle and give me a screen of fire. When I give the word, head toward the rocks the shooters are using as cover and put a wall of fire between them and us. You understand?"
"Sir, yes, sir,"
they replied in unison, and hissing blue cones of heat ignited from the weapon systems fixed to their gauntlets. Satisfied the firebats understood their tasks, Arcturus then spoke to the resocked Marines who had survived the crash and were still fit to fight. He pointed to the nearest Marines and said,
"You two stay with the wounded. The rest of you, I want you supporting Malik and Utley. I want a stream of impalers keeping those bastards' heads down. Got that?"
Nodding heads and snapped salutes assured him they understood, and Arcturus returned his attention to his own soldiers as ricocheting impaler spike thudded into his shoulder guard.
"What's the plan, LT?"
shouted Dia DeSanto as Arcturus brushed the spike from his armor as though it were a piece of lint on his best suit.
"We're going to take out those gunmen and push on," said Arcturus.
"Sir, that's crazy," cried Chuck Horner. "We ain't got a damn clue how many more of them are waiting for us up there."
Arcturus shook his head, jabbing his fist at the Marines of Dominion Section.
"We're going, and that's an order. When the firebats and what's left of Emelian's Marines make their move, I want Horner, Mercurio, and Yancey up and over the rocks on the right. The rest of you with me on the left."
He could see the fear and doubt on their faces and said,
"Listen, soldiers, there's probably more of them moving around our flank already to cut us off."
Given the terrain and the fact that they were pinned down quite neatly here, that probably wasn't true, but it didn't hurt to put the fear of it into them.
"Either we go forward and take this fight to them, or we get cut to pieces like rookies," shouted Arcturus. "We're Dominion Section, and we kill anyone who gets in our way."
Chun Liang hefted Mayumi and slammed in a fresh clip.
"Now you're talking my language," he said.
Chapter 8. Blazing plumes of liquid fire roared up the valley as Privates Malik and Utley broke from cover. The two red-armored warriors crunched forward, flaming sheets spraying the rocks and brush of the valley ahead. Arcturus could feel the backwash of heat from their flamethrowers through his armor. Impaler spikes hammered the two firebats, but their armor was thicker and heavier than that of an ordinary Marine, and the two privates pushed on in the face of the gunfire. The brush around the enemy gunmen went up instantly, crackling and burning with furious glee.
"Go!" shouted Arcturus, scrambling up the rocky slope beside him.
Chun Liang and Dia DeSanto followed him, their rifles tucked in close to their chests. More rattling gunfire blazed from below as Emelian's marines followed the firebats, shooting from the hip as they advanced. One marine was cut down the instant he left cover, a hail of razor-tipped spikes splintering his visor and blowing out the back of his helmet. The others didn't falter, and advanced into the teeth of the fusillade. Arcturus clawed at the rocks, pulling himself up with powerful surges. His armor enhanced his strength, and he was able to haul himself over the lip of the canyon walls without difficulty. He rolled onto his side and brought his gauze rifle up, glancing across to see Yancey, Chuck, and Toby pulling themselves over the rocks and into cover. Below him, the firebats continued to pour flaming gouts of superheated liquid at their foes. One of them, Arcturus didn't know which, was limping badly, his leg armor mangled by gunfire above the knee and blood sheeting down his thigh. Several other marines were down, but the mercenaries' attention was fixated on the advancing warriors, and they hadn't noticed the other inbound enemies. Arcturus opened a link to Dominion section and said, "Get moving, everyone! Fast and low!"
"You got it, LT!" said Chuck Horner,
leading Yancey and Mercurio off. Arcturus nodded to himself. Horner had real potential, naturally assuming command of his small section, and Arcturus made a mental note to see about developing his skills if they survived this encounter.
"Chun, Dia," he said, "let's go."
Arcturus led them off, scuttling forward, hunched over as much as his armor would allow, and keeping to the cover of the rocks. His heart was hammering in his chest as he ran, fully expecting a burst of impaler spikes to rake him and his soldiers at any moment. Arcturus could hear a near continual roar of gunfire, screams, and explosions from the canyon, and knew the men he'd sent forward were still fighting. An angry orange fireball mushroomed from below, signaling the death of one of the firebats, followed moments later by a second explosion. The reek of flamethrower fuel filled the air, and Arcturus heard more screams of dying soldiers. Just ahead, he could see a splash of white and recognize the rocks above where their ambushers were fighting. He grinned with feral anticipation, terrified yet exhilarated at the same time. Arcturus dropped to one knee and jabbed a fist at the white rocks.
"Take up position either side of me," he said. "We get to those rocks and unleash everything we got."
DeSanto and Leung nodded, and Arcturus could see the same relish on their faces he figured they could see on his.
"Let's do this," hissed Chun Liang, patting Mayumi's gleaming barrel.
"You got it, big dog,"
replied DeSanto, punching knuckles with Liang.
"Let's go,"
said Arcturus. He ran over to the rocks, bracing his foot against a low boulder, and looked down into the canyon as DeSanto and Liang took up position. Below them was a scene straight from hell, the valley floor aflame and littered with blackened bodies. A few fallen mercenaries screamed and clutched bloody wounds, but Arcturus didn't care about their pain. These men had tried to kill him and his marines, and that made them less than nothing in his eyes. As he'd suspected, both firebats were dead, as were about half of Emelian's resocked marines, but they had done their